Hey everyone, this is the Philosophy Junkie and I welcome you today to philosophize alongside me. If you end up liking this episode or any other episode on this podcast, check out our website, link down below. You can find summaries and even transcripts for each and every show there and also a link to support us. Visit us on Instagram and Twitter @ThePhilosophyJunkie and @TheFilJunkie. Furthermore, if you're feeling generous today, you can visit our page on patreon.com/thephilosophyjunkie and consider donating money for some additional content. Just a disclaimer before we begin though, I would recommend you bear in mind that our journey won't be one of name dropping, but rather be focused on thoughts, ideologies and beliefs. We will focus more on the what rather than the who of things. Thank you for choosing this podcast to fill your time of the day today, and I really hope you enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, today we'll be engaging in quite an interesting discussion on a topic less explored in the realm of philosophy, but about a philosopher who is way too explored in that same realm of philosophy. Sometimes whilst learning philosophy, we tend to forgo the background of philosophers with whom we're engaging in those texts. For example, to understand Platonic philosophy, it is imperative that we understand the Peloponnesian War and the Plague of Athens that were occurring during that time. Similarly, to understand Kantian philosophy, it is probably extremely important to understand the Age of Enlightenment, which is basically the European philosophical movement from 1715 to 1789. Now, it is probably easy to understand Kant during his day and age. I mean, context makes everything seem fine. But if his ideas were to be implemented or given attention to today, the cultural distance might seem way too big to be feasible, especially when it comes to important societal matters such as feminism, sexism, and racism. What were Kant's thoughts on these, and do his philosophies contradict his very thoughts? Well, to discuss the same, we have two extremely distinguished philosophy professors with us today. We have Professor Lucy Elias, who is currently jointly appointed at the University of Witwatersrand and the University of California at San Diego, currently, and she is also the Henry E. Allison Chair of the History of Philosophy at UCSD. She's been exploring Kantian philosophy, in particular his idealism and realism, for about 20 years now, if I'm not wrong. We also have Professor Helga Worden with us, who is a philosophy professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And she is also quite an extensive writer of Kantian theory, extending into the fields of sexuality and gender, but also Kantian applied ethics in a manner. It is a pleasure to have you both on the podcast today.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
Just to keep in mind, even though it is Kant, you both explore different realms of Kantian philosophy. And so I'll try my best to keep the conversation broad enough, but also detailed to an extent. So starting off, both of you in multiple lectures and publications of yours have always said that even though Kant had some politically incorrect opinions, he is still brilliant. Do you think it's because we have been able to interpret Kant so well that now we are willing to treat his philosophy and mold it in a manner that is culturally appropriate?
Do you want to start, Lucy?
I think that's a really complicated question because I don't quite know how to go about saying this, but I think that I do deeply believe that there are insights in his philosophy that continue to be deeply important and helpful for us today. But I don't think it would be straightforwardly because we can mold it to contemporary reality. And I almost think that part of the work Helga and I have been doing in paying attention to his racism and his sexism is trying not to mold it too quickly to contemporary issues. So first trying to work out exactly what he really is saying about some of these issues rather than, so for quite some time when people were working on Kant's moral philosophy, they would just say, well, you know, maybe he thought some things about race and gender that we wouldn't want to say today, but let's just put that aside and just assume that the theories apply to everybody. And in a way, I think we've been pushing back on that and saying, like, let's look really carefully at his racism and his sexism to work out exactly where and how he goes wrong. And I think, going back to your point about him being brilliant, I think it would be really a mistake to think that incredible intellectual brilliance is incompatible with racism and sexism. I think we would be sort of misunderstanding what these phenomena really are if we think, well, if he was brilliant, he couldn't have been a racist, so let's try to, you know, that can't quite have been right. So what we want to do, I think, is take this brilliant thinker who in some places went terribly, terribly wrong, as every brilliant thinker has, and really try to understand where and how he's gone wrong. And that will enable us maybe to get insight into ways in which we might go wrong, and then also to take the ideas which really are brilliant and which could be helpful to us today.
I think very similarly to Lucy on some of these topics. Maybe I could add just a couple of things going back to your question. So I think the work that Lucy and I are doing is not proceeding on the assumption that he is, when he says this horribly racist, sexist, for that matter, you can add heterosexist things, it's not political correctness, right? So where this is coming from is not just trying or just going along with opinions. In some of Lucy's published work too, she's also pointed out that, and for that matter, so have I, when he thinks he's being offensive or rude, he can even sometimes say he is being offensive and rude, but he thinks it's the truth. So I don't, and in addition, I mean, Kant really revolutionized thinking about very important issues about morality, and in particular freedom and human dignity. So when he says these horrible things, it is not as if he's not generally used to going against the norm or saying something different. So I think one way to say it is that when what Lucy and I are trying to do and thinking it is both humanly and philosophically important is to look Kant and his mistakes in the eyes. Because something about keeping trying to look the mistakes and the awful things in the eyes may be important in order to see the human temptation to do these and say these and mean these horrible things. So perhaps, or another way to say it, but then brings it back to Lucy's point, I believe, is to say that to understand human beings, and including brilliant human beings, we are probably doing ourselves an enormous disfavor in the least if we set aside these sides of the thinking, which is morally and humanly extremely troublesome.
If I could just add something as well. You said in the opening that, you know, some of these historical thinkers, their sexism and their racism looks maybe different when we take them in that context, but unacceptable today. But I think actually in some ways that can be letting them, and in particular Kant, off too easily, because Kant engaged with people who had better views on race and gender than he did. You know, he engaged with people who were defending rights for women. He engaged with people who were anti-slavery. And so he wasn't unaware of these ideas. It's not like they were unthinkable somehow. You know, sometimes we're looking at people at a past era and we think, well, you know, we can't blame people for not thinking a thought that was, nobody was thinking back then. And that's just not true in this case. So actually that makes things worse for him.
So, I mean, what I'm gathering from this is that Kant was not coming from a place of innocence, where he was not coming from a place where he did not know what was happening. But he was coming from a place of ignorance, that even though he understood that these concepts existed and so processes might apply to gender and race, he was still quite repulsive towards them. But one thing to take note of is that even though he was ignorant, he did not make sure that we know about it. Later on, when he at least we presume that he changed his opinions when we come to his intellectual corpus, which is groundworks of the metaphysics of morals. So do you think it's something that he should have done, in that sense that we should have known if he was changing his opinion? Because many philosophers during their time, and many great thinkers, one that extremely quickly comes to my mind is Stephen Hawking. When he changed his perspective on black holes, he absolutely flipped that my PhD thesis was wrong, and this is the actual thing, and this is what I'm trying to prove, and he died proving it. So do you think something similar, or even Plato for that matter, he changed his opinion throughout that one book, which is The Republic. Do you think something like that should have been the way Kant should have dealt with his change of opinion, or at least our presumption that he has changed his opinion throughout his academic life?
So it's a great question. And again, it's a complex one. So one complexity is, you know, there's debate about the extent to which he really did change his views on race and gender. So some people, Pauline Klangelt, for example, has argued that his views on race really improve. And I agree with her that they do. Some people argue against that. But we might not think they improve as much as we would have wanted them to. And it's not entirely clear that his views on gender improve. I mean, they certainly don't improve nearly as much as we would want them to. So even in very late works, he still, doesn't think, for example, that women should be able to vote. So that's one issue. But I agree with you that there is an improvement. And then we might ask, so what the first question is there really an improvement? Is there a change? There's debate about that. I think there is, but we should just know that there's debate. Then there's a question, should he have noted that improvement? This is actually, I think, a fascinating thing in Kant's work more broadly. He never, almost never, on any issue, just on sort of complicated, on thick, abstract theoretical issues, nothing to do with anything political, he never acknowledges when he changes his mind. It's quite strange, actually. You know, so there's some central theories in, like, the Critique of Pure Reason, his metaphysics and epistemology, where he's presenting as just basically straightforwardly, obviously true, something which he himself didn't think 10 years ago. He thought the opposite. And he never says, I used to think that, you know, this about synthetic truths, and now I think that there are synthetic a priori truths. Or he just doesn't ever note that he's changing his mind. So that's kind of a general feature of Kant's philosophy on all sorts of questions. And one might think it is a pretty problematic character trait to have, to never notice that you've changed your views or that you were ever wrong in the past. And you might think that even if you tend to write like that about, you know, the analytic synthetic distinction, that you don't want to acknowledge that you once were wrong about the analytic synthetic distinction. When you change your mind on something like race, you really, then there's even more reason to acknowledge it because of its importance for how people are treated. So I would agree with you that he should acknowledge it to the extent that there is change.
Yeah. On the issue of change, I think you can make a fairly good case that he does change his view on race, at least improve it.
Improve it, I agree.
Right. And then gender, I think he was very worried actually about his view all along. So I'm not as sure that he really did change it, but I also don't think it was as horrible. And then on heterosexism, I don't see any sign of improvement ever. So but all of those things are important in themselves to explore, you know, to what extent did he change his view? Then two things. One is on Lucy's point in general, like as a thinker, when you realize that you were wrong, and something about the virtue or the importance rather, the importance of saying so, that there's something about maybe pursuing truth that sort of being too proud or not to emphasize that that must have been wrong before, that can't have been right. There's something about the nature of pursuing truth that seems to invite that kind of an attitude where whether or not to admit that, yeah, definitely I didn't get that one right. I think this one is better. It seems to be constitutive of doing it well. And Kant doesn't seem to have that virtue or quality. But I have a feeling, but I can't. So it's just a feeling, a sort of a gut, that I suspect this question relates to some deeper feature of human beings, especially when it comes to having not only changed your mind, but as Lucy was also after, like having had horrible views. And I don't think Kant is special in lacking an ability to even be around and say that, you know what? I dehumanized. I had all those associations. It was part of, it's part of who I have been. And in fact, it's not something I can easily fix. So if you have had sexist views, if you have had heterosexist views, or if you have had racist views, there's something about both the kind of humbling it involves to actually own what those views are and how you even have had them somewhat reflectively, but also starting to dare to what that means, what kinds of associations and feelings you've had on about it unreflectively. I think it's extremely hard for us as human beings. So I believe that Kant's troubles in this regard is related not just to a general feature of academia, but also a general feature in us, namely that it's difficult to own if you really have gotten this wrong, right? This basic stuff, which involves dehumanizing others and saying I did. And then even worse, to admit that the nature of these things is such that I can strive to improve it, but just getting completely rid of it, insofar as we have grown up in racist, sexist, heterosexist cultures, is actually extraordinarily difficult. So I think it's not just Kant's problem. I think it's a human problem.
I would agree with that. I would add, I think that this again is just a gut feeling, but Kant feels to me from his writing, so I agree with Helga that everything she was saying there I think is a human problem, but I think in addition he feels very prickly as a person. He feels like someone who took offense easily and was proud. I mean, when you read the way he engages with people who've written about his work, he's always so furious and angry. He's always so angry and rude, and he's sarcastic about other people. And he doesn't seem to have been, you know, a person can be very, very brilliant intellectually and have all sorts of emotional issues that they haven't resolved and understood that lead to their having all sorts of defenses and responses that they aren't fully, that they don't have insight into and don't have control of, despite being incredibly brilliant. And going back to your very first opening where you said, thinking about these philosophers as humans, as persons who have their own characters and all these flaws that humans have, I think is part of the whole picture.
Yeah, no. I think that's all of that is super important. And also on Kant as a person, but again, I wonder if that aspect of him as a person is also tied to these issues. So Kant as a life, Kant's life also involved in some ways living unconventionally, meaning that in that somewhat unconventionally, including in that, you know, his very close friends were all men, and it's not so unconventional in academia, certainly. But But also it seems to be true that the person who was closest and most intimate with him as in the very least a very dear personal friend for over 20 years, it had dimensions to it that is very difficult for me to think that Kant ever was able to own. And so I think if he were to be able to own any of that complexity, he would have been much, much more gentle around issues involving people's sexuality. Again, when it comes to people's sexuality, it's one of those places where you can't find Kant being almost enraged, right? Talking about how horrible it is to masturbate, or how horrible unnatural sex is, or horrible, horrible, horrible. And he's so angry, right? So it's sort of, it's a lot of rationalized anger, there's lots of theories around it and all kinds of things, but importantly, it's angry. And I think too, when it comes to, so both in the personal intimate sphere, which I think tracks then how you are able to be around complexities regarding sexuality or not being able to do it. So you become either very condescending or very angry around people's different kinds of sexuality. But also around the whole women issue, which you can have fairly good arguments that is an aspect of Kant's life that he didn't have a lot of familiarity. He had a couple of women he definitely was very fond of and thought were quite wonderful. There were sort of friends in the friends around friends of his. But there's something about these issues. In other words, and the way in which they interact with you and your personal life and challenges, that I think it doesn't matter how brilliant you are reflectively, once those issues are engaged, your maturity, or for lack of a better word, is revealed when you write, including in your anger or your condescension.
No, absolutely. I agree with what you're saying. And then again, it seems like maybe when someone questioned him, or try to critique his work in a manner that was not according to what he wanted. Maybe his male ego was just hurt. I mean, I think making it more concise, we can also keep it at that. But so now that we've discussed what Kant, how we view Kant's theories and how he changed, I think it's the right time to dive into what his theories actually were. So maybe we can start with sexism and how Kant related to women, gender, and his views on what one gender was to be perceived as, and how the other gender was a bit dominant as compared to, and how there were only two genders according to him. So Professor Warden, would you like to elucidate upon how is Kant a sexist, and does he change his opinions by the end of his life, or did he not?
Right. Yeah, I don't think he really ever changed his opinions. I think he was never the issue around women is one, I think, where he was not confident from the start, and he actually did even explicitly say that he wasn't sure whether, and he kept on using language like, I'm now talking as an observer, not as a philosopher, but I think that, et cetera, et cetera. So I think he wasn't quite convinced ever that he did get that one right. But that's, of course, in itself controversial. Basically, to understand Kant's theory of the distinction between male and female, we need to engage two other aspects, in the very least, of his philosophy than his writings on freedom. So from the point of view of freedom, which means whether or not you can be morally responsible, the issues of gender, men and women, don't appear. So from that point of view, when you want to explain what Kant thinks is moral responsibility, so the fact that we can be morally responsible for our actions, this type of account never appeals to anything that has to do with the fact that we are embodied in social beings. All it appeals to is the fact that we have certain reflective capacities that ultimately enable us to set ends of our own, and or what in Kantianese would be called to act on maxims. And then we can also consider whether or not whatever ends we are setting is consistent with respecting other people, people's end setting, and also support them in their pursuit of happiness. So all of those arguments are not appealing to anything that has to do with the distinction between men and women. So where you have to go to find those kinds of arguments is in his account of human nature, which is not much studied. And also that held together with his theory of aesthetic judgment of beautiful and sublime. So I wish I could give a 30-second version of this. Maybe Lucy can do it on my behalf. But basically, Kant thinks that our human nature is wired slightly differently when it comes to men and women. And this slight difference in wiring is also combined with different types of aesthetic ideals. So women, both men and women strive, so to say, to realize their animality, to preserve themselves. They have a sex drive. They love affectionately others so they can feel safe and at home together with others. They strive to realize this through this animality, through what he calls their predisposition to humanity, which is combined of a social sense of self, namely that I have a sense of myself as I'm being viewed by others, as well as the capacity to set ends of my own. Now, this both this animality, the sexual striving, right, and what makes me feel safe and loved, and the way in which that's strived into this social sense of self is where Kant proposes that we come in two different modes, namely male and female. And he thinks in part the reasons for this is biological, meaning that women are the only kinds of beings that can carry children. And so they will have a sort of a way of being oriented in the world that is fundamentally tuned into a home and to take care of that home. And also they have an aesthetic way about them that is closely linked to the beautiful, meaning to attract. And so women, on his own account, both biologically strive in a way that's consistent with becoming pregnant and consistent with presenting as beautiful or attractive, whereas men, contrastingly, do not get pregnant. So they go out and hunt, and they are striving to then protect this woman and the child, etc., etc., so to protect the home. And they are aesthetically, they strive to be sublime, meaning to be powerful, empowering, or taking. And so he thinks then that this biological, organic conception together with this aesthetic, social sense yields to gender ideals, namely the woman as the one who ultimately protects the home, realizes all of that, and attracts the man. And then the man and experiences the sublime in intimate, personal, sexual, affectionate, etc., experiences the sublime through the man, and then the man who has the complementary striving, natural striving, namely he strives to be powerful, protective, and he gets to experience the beautiful through the woman. And so that's his account of how come we have two genders, and how come in some important way it's something in the striving of women and male life itself that is two genders. I don't know if that was possible to follow.
Oh no, I think it definitely was, and it has something to, especially when you mention the beautiful and the sublime, which is exactly where he explains and appears as quite sexist, and his views are on the wrong side of the radical in that sense. Professor Lucy, then I'll come to you with this. how is Kant, according to you, a racist? And how do you think, personally, that he changed by the end of his life, when, like, by the end of his academic life?
So there are three things, at least three things, we can look at in looking at Kant's racism. One is that for a large part of his academic life, he fails to condemn slavery. Some people have argued that he supports slavery. I don't myself really see textual evidence for that. But you would think that somebody who has the moral and political philosophy that Kant has, who is aware of the transatlantic slave trade in Black Africans, would be horrified by this and would be speaking out strongly against it. And he just doesn't. And he's aware of people who are arguing for abolitionism, and he just doesn't say anything. And that's, I think, is pretty shocking in the relation to his what we would expect from him, given his moral and political thoughts. So that does seem to indicate something problematic. Then there are a number of just what I want to almost call casual racism. And by casual, I don't mean not serious. I mean, he'll just sort of, in a throwaway remark, he'll just talk about some throwaway remark about Black people not being less intelligent or not having talents, or somebody being completely Black from head to foot as proof that he was stupid. So it's not presented as part of any kind of systematic view, like Helga just gave us with gender, you know, a quite systematic basis for thinking that there are these really quite different kinds of aesthetic responses in the beautiful and the sublime. They're these sort of racist comments, which are not part of any systematic theory. They're just racist things that he says. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing, which is a bit more complicated in a way, is that he has a theory of race. And he's one of the first people to really try to systematically theorize race. And he himself sees his theory of race as a novel, as an important new development. Now, not all theories of what race is are equally racist. So, for example, my colleague Michael Hardiman at the University of California, San Diego, argues for what he calls minimal race realism. So he believes that humanity divides into groups that are sort of real divisions, and they correspond to continental origins. And what characterizes these groups is clusters of trivial, physical, observable characteristics. So he thinks that race is real, but it's totally superficial, trivial, and unimportant. So there are different kinds of theories one could have of race, and they're differently racist. Kant's theory of race is not in itself necessarily hierarchical or racist. He thinks that humanity divides into groups which are linked to continental origins, which have different, definitely at least physical, observable characteristics, which are a result of capacities that the original humans had in them that were activated by different geographical climates. So, for example, needing darker skin in a particular climate, he thinks that that was something that the original humans had the capacity to develop different skin colors. This capacity was triggered differently in different geographical environments. And his theory of racial characteristics is that they're the characteristics which, once triggered, become unfailingly heritable. So there are bits of this theory, I mean, there are bits of it which are just sort of empirically ignorant. He just doesn't understand how genetics work. There are bits of it that are quite common to people at his time and even people who want to defend minimal race realism today. And then there are bits that are more racist. So he talks about the different races as having different temperaments. And he talks about some of the races as being more lazy, obviously not the white race. But there are parts of his theory of race that are not necessarily hierarchical or racist. And then there are things he says about the races in the context of talking about his theory that are more clearly racist. So that's a kind of a more mixed picture.
Yeah, let me also come in on just going off of what Lucy is just talking about, which is, I didn't ever said what makes this sexist or his views makes it sexist. Definitely his view, what it makes his position sexist is not as such the theory that I gave a little bit ago. What makes it ultimately sexist for Kant's theory is sexist is also not anything having to do with moral responsibility as such. I think he never says that women can't be morally responsible. Some think that, but I think that's just not true. What he thinks, and here comes the sexism, is that he didn't envision that women could engage in public reasoning properly understood. And the reason in some ways is related to what you said, Tanish, which was the stuff about the sublime. So Kant thinks that a sublime way of being is closer to related to exactly reasoning. And so public reasoning requires to use your reasoning capacities well. And when you use your reasoning capacities well, whether it is as scholarly work, as a philosopher, or just as a thinker, or as somebody who is involved in legal political reasoning, and especially legal reasoning, so presenting arguments in court, et cetera, et cetera. He thought that women, and that's, as Lucy mentioned, they couldn't vote, why not? Because he thought that they were not capable of doing that exactly because they were more drawn to the beautiful rather than sublime, and so that they possibly, their capacities didn't allow for that development. So part of what makes him sexist then is this way in which he then ascribes women to the position of passive citizens and men to active citizens. If we have time, I would also like to talk about why, despite all of that, why I think Kant's theory as a whole is worth exploring or developing. So in some ways, why he has what we need to develop more convincing conceptions of sexual identity and sexual orientation. And that engages or links with Lucy's point, because in some ways, I'm at least currently of the opinion that there are such things as sexual identities and orientations. They don't line up in the way Kant thinks, but I do think that in some profound way there is such a thing, whereas I'm more convinced of those who would argue that when it comes to racism or racialization, that goes all the way down. That is, that there is a very profound way in which there is no such thing as race. There's racialization, but not race.
So you're saying that it is important for us to see race, but make it like treated in a very trivial fashion, that it's something that is there, but it doesn't affect anything. And then you're saying that it is important for us to take note of sexual orientations because they're not just trivial. They actually matter in the social realm.
So I just to be clear, I was reporting that my colleague, Michael Hardiman, argues for minimal race realism. I don't myself subscribe to that view. As Helga just put it, I agree with the view she just presented that races just don't exist at all. So, of course, people do have some observable physical differences, but I don't think they correspond to groups which it makes there's anything meaningful in calling them racist, that there's anything biologically real there. On the other hand, it does seem to me, I mean, I would need to think about this a lot more carefully, but on the basis of my current thought that there is something like sexual orientation and that there are genders. So I think there's a really big difference there. Now, so I think with respect to race, Kant is trying to theorize something that doesn't exist, but was incredibly historically influential. Kant's theory of race really comes down to us and really influenced the whole development of the modern European concept of race. So it's something that's incredibly important to understand. Both his theory of race and his racism are things that it's really important for us to understand. I think Helger is suggesting that with respect to sex and gender, despite having got things wrong, he might also have something to help us understand about how to theorize about what those things really are, which I don't think he could do with race, because there I think he's theorizing something that doesn't exist.
So here's one way to perhaps put that point. Of course, we need to be very sort of clear on what it means to exist. Racialization, I think both Lucy and I just agree, there's racialization. People are racialized all the time, and it matters very much to understand our reality, how we are racialized. But in a fundamental sense, I don't know yet of any reasons to think that there is such a thing as race. Perhaps one way to see it is borrowing now from Lucy's concept of like biological. So there's a way in which you could hear that story that I told about Kant's account of why we have the distinction between men and women, as sort of simply being a biological story of thought. I don't think he thought that, even though it trails certain biological features of us, right? So we're embodied beings, we have a natural striving to self-preservation, we have in certain sense, a natural strive to sex drive and to what he calls basic community or affectionate loving relations. So it's tempting perhaps to think of that as just biological, but I don't think it is for Kant. Both Kant, the person Kant, and also the philosophical position, Kantian position. It's called a predisposition to good. And I think Kant thinks that this predisposition is enabled by the three relational categories of the understanding, right? So substance, causality, and community, which means that there's a way in which our embodied forcefulness is structured by, for lack of a better word, but a way of conscious striving. And that conscious striving then relates to the fact that we have a natural forcefulness in us that we can pay attention to. But it would be wrong to think of that as just something happening through my body. So let me put this differently. In my view, a good account of sexual identity has to be able to explain trans. And I believe this type of philosophical account is good at explaining that. Just like it's quite good at explaining people who are straight, who are gay, who are bisexual. Namely, it's you can experience your own forcefulness as both being realized in your own person, consistent with your aesthetic appreciation of yourself, whether it's towards the sublime or the beautiful, and how you are embodied and what you can do with your body, including sexually or affectionately, lovingly, and what feels safe and good. These are all the categories of animality, and how others can become complementary of that. And so how you can use a judgment where they can help you to feel whole together with them. And so I take it that when you are a trans woman, for example, and if you are a trans woman for whom transitioning is important, then I think it's important for those stories, when you hear them tell the story of how it is to be in the world with that subjectivity, to be able to change your embodiment such that it is consistent with how you subjectively feel. And so to be a woman, right? So to identify as a woman would be misunderstood if you look at some biological features you're born with. There's a very profound way in which you're paying attention to that person's experience of their own subjective striving to be safe, self-preservation, to feel sexually attractive, and to feel beautiful and lovable as who you are. Similarly, if you're straight, then you, if you change to sexual orientation, you're straight, there's a way in which you feel others' embodiments and ways can complement yours, and it becomes very existentially important. So so part of going back to it, I think these, what Kant is right about is to emphasize the way in which our subjectivity and the way in which we can feel that striving and our conscious striving, we can get it right and wrong, is constitutive of sexual identity, sexual orientation. And so it's something important about growing is to learning to pay attention to that and to be able to flourish as the person you are. And then if you contrast, the one reason right now I'm saying that in a very profound way, there is no such thing as race, is that I don't believe there is such a subjective striving there for you to realize and to be in line with. And so in that sense, though there is, and his account can help us to understand sexual identity orientation, when it comes to race, I neither hear stories similar to those who experience struggles with sexual identity orientation in people who have to live with serious oppression involving racism. And there is no feature, as far as I can tell, that would be corresponding to that kind of unreflective or just conscious striving when it comes to race.
Now, when you're talking about sexual orientation, it's something that's very important to recognize today. But let's say even like 20 years back, if it's not that big of a deal, 50 years back, people were very against it. So thinking that maybe let's say 200 to 50 years back when Kant actually lived, it was something that was practically non-existent for them. So I mean, it was obviously there, but it was not being normalized in society. So I know that you've both covered this a lot during your talks, in your publications, in your lectures, how you cannot, the liberal philosophy that revolves around or has been started by Kant and then carried forward by so many, it cannot be put on a political spectrum like we thought it could. You cannot make that, you cannot make plot where you are on the political spectrum anymore, because liberal doesn't necessarily mean left anymore. Liberal doesn't necessarily mean right anymore, where you think I'm a capitalist, but I don't like the government intervening in my work. So in that sense, what I think of this, of how it comes about, is the fact that his liberal philosophy is more to do with a liberal or a free mindset, where you can imagine such identities to exist if those people feel that they have such identities within themselves, and they can process them in a sense that is true to them, unique to them, and that the government or the society cannot intervene in this process through which they are identifying themselves. From that, I would like to move on to a question that kind of relates to what we were just talking about with regards to how his theoretical aspect, for example, how he talks about, one thing to take note of would be that in books like The Groundworks of the Metaphysics of Morals or Critique of Practical Reason, etc., we don't see a distinction between men and women. It's always citizens or people or you. He's never pointing out gender. So that in that sense, people think that, oh, he probably has changed. Do you think we were always looking at it in a wrong format, considering that his a priori deductions, in a sense, are quite different from the empirical explanations that might be present out there? So it's like an open question to both of you. How are Kant's a priori deductions different from the empirical realities that might exist or that he believes in? And does he himself lay down a certain disbelief in how things actually function and how things might be rationally theorized in that sense.
So I'll let Lucy answer your main question first, but just before she does, I believe you're not right in thinking that 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 200 years ago, people didn't care about sexual identity and orientation. So an easy way to say that Kant didn't think so is that he writes about it. He definitely knows that there are gay people. And he writes very angrily about gay sex, or he definitely knows that there some women disagreed with him when it came to his views on women. So it's not the case that this didn't matter 20 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever, even though today it is the case that one can speak more openly and freely about it. But then I'll let Lucy have a go at the a priori stuff.
So that was a super complicated question. And I don't actually think there's a simple answer to it. So on the one hand, we have these, Kant is, of course, very concerned with very abstract accounts of the a priori conditions of the possibility of various human phenomena. And then he also has these parts of his work that make more empirical claims. And he sees the more empirical claims as being much less certain. I think he rightly is hesitant about some of them. So one might be tempted to think, well, some of the things he says about gender and race and sex and sexuality and race are on the empirical side of things that he himself admits he's uncertain about. And we don't have to, and we could think that the more a priori abstract parts of the account are not meant to be informed by that. But I think that would be too quick to assume that. And again, this is something Pauline Kleingeld has written a lot about. We shouldn't be too quick to assume that these figures of the past writing about terms which could be taken to refer to all humans aren't in fact just talking about white men. I think we have to constantly have that as a possibility, that he's failing to refer to everybody when he's talking about some of these more general claims. Then, of course, there's the further question about whether the claims that he's making in the a priori parts of his account can be even if he didn't intend them to refer to everybody, whether they can't be taken in that way, and what would follow from taking them in that way. And there, I think I really agree with you about the importance of rethinking what liberalism really means, in that I think we haven't really rethought what all of this would mean, taking these prejudices out of it, including the prejudices of the property-owning people.
Yeah, I also think that is right. And I also think that just because we are currently thinking about that, that is now we are perhaps more aware of those dangers than perhaps 20 years ago. It doesn't mean that we are transparent to it either. I mean, it's very tempting, I think, and certainly in academia, to think that because we think and worry a lot about ways in which we can dehumanize others and all ways in which we can reform society to make it better and truly more free, that because we are worried about that, we don't actually reinstantiate various kinds of human tendency to dehumanize after all. I mean, just because we can see them maybe more clearly now and perhaps think it's important to see them more clearly in Kant himself, it doesn't mean that we don't also do it. So isn't maybe not just an importance in general when we read these classical works, but it's also an important reminder continuously about ourselves.
And I think that's part of why it's so important to look at this, and part of why it's so important not to think that there's a tension between having these dehumanizing attitudes and being brilliant. Like, one can just have both.
No, absolutely. I think I agree with that, because it's not like all great leaders or all great thinkers were not dehumanizing in that sense. One example that comes to my mind, and they were at multiple times very, very politically incorrect, but I think that was overshadowed by what the work that they did. For example, I think it's the 12th of October today. We just 10 days back had the birthday of Mahatma Gandhi, who is an Indian freedom fighter and one of the biggest leaders to have ever lived. And when you read about him, not his works, but rather when you read about what people have written about him, like we read what people have written about Kant to actually understand where Kant is coming from. When we read what people have written about Mahatma Gandhi, we realize that Mahatma Gandhi was not only a sexist in that sense that he did not let women come to protests and do his infamous salt march with him, but he was also a racist. And to imagine that Mahatma Gandhi inspired people like Martin Luther King and his work in South Africa and how he helped inspire them to fight that racial injustice there. And to think that he was himself a racially unjust person is baffling. So similarly, what I think here is something similar is happening with Kant, is that even though he was a sexist and a racist, I mean, he was a racist and that cannot be let go. But when we talk about his sexism, we also take into account that with his theories, we can now give a new shape to feminist ethics. We can now think about how feminist ethics should be structured. And to think that he was the one who was sexist and he was the one who very straightforwardly dismissed women's rights in the very basic of terms. So I think that's a sort of parallel that we can draw, that it's not that the great thinkers of previous generations were not dehumanizing, were not politically incorrect, and so much that they are hypocritical in a very great fashion, and it's quite visible to us, but sometimes we choose to ignore it. For example, it was only till recent that I started to realize that maybe Kant's writings were sexist. And that's when I started to explore this topic. And I thought, maybe why not read some literature on it? And that's when you start realizing that, oh, maybe there's something wrong with it. And it comes with cultural appropriation as well. When now I've started to realize, though, that, you know, feminism needs to be a thing, is when I've started to pay attention to such philosophies back in the 1700s, 1800s, 1600s, etc., etc. To end at that note, I just one question before we start. Maybe we can have some book recommendations after that. Just one simple question: does this revival of Kantian ethics in a culturally appropriate format change our views on these issues or on him, considering that he was such a big thinker that his philosophies are not just philosophies in general, but are Kantian philosophies now? So his persona is also a big factor in these things. Do you think this revival has changed our views on these issues and like taken so added a layer of Kantian philosophy onto it, or do you think it has changed our views on him and we now view him in a different light, but keeping in mind that he was not viewed like this before?
I would say a bit of both, and it's a complicated story. And I would say that there are parts of Kant's views that have informed our present views in bad ways, and then parts which could really contribute in good ways. I mean, I think part of what Helga was talking about earlier, about theorizing sexual identity and trans identity in particular, is the extent to which there's this amazing thought in Kant that she, I think, very brilliantly brings out in a book about how we can't do this adequately from the perspective just of biology or the perspective just of choice. And those are the two dominant frameworks we have had for thinking about these issues. So we actually find here in Kant some materials to really do it better and to really think about these things in a better way. And then on the changing our view of Kant, I think that has also happened. I think people are gaining an increasingly nuanced and more carefully informed view of him.
Yeah, let me follow that. And both of you, starting at the end, which is, I think it's good. Whether it is Mary Wollstonecraft, who, for example, says terrible things about Muslims, or whether it is Frederick Douglass and what he says about Native Americans, or whether it's James Baldwin, and sometimes when he talks both about problematic ways in which he responds to women suffering, let me say it like that, and but also he's actually gay, but his way of talking around gayness is very complicated at times. In other words, like Kant, these great and important figures, I think it behooves us and them, in certain sense, we owe it also to them, to dare to look at them more truthfully, and so to also to look at ourselves more truthfully. And then, as Lucy was complimenting one of the things she likes about my work on this, let me compliment her. So one of the things that I love and have learned so much about from Lucy's work on racism, and then the way in which she draws on Kant to bring out this feature, is on the nature of evil. I don't think that work for any of us is finished, but Kant has, one of the fantastic things about Kant is his account of evil. And I like the way in which Lucy makes available to us this notion that when we do bad, our minds are incoherent, and Kant has an account of that. But if it, put it differently too, if it weren't the case that it makes us uncomfortable to look at this incoherence in others and in ourselves, but more generally, if it weren't the case that they were incoherent, how could we be responsible for them? But if you put it, spin it the other way, to be responsible is to learn to practice noticing and paying attention to incoherence, and so to our tendency to do very bad things. And I think that's one of the ways in which, one of them, but one of the ways in which you can learn great things from Kant via Lucy Elias.
Well, thanks very much.
That was beautiful. Just before we end, would you have any recommendations on what we can read with respect to Kantian views on race and Kantian views on sex?
Well, Helga has a brilliant book recently published with Oxford University Press on a Kantian theory of gender, sex, and sexuality. So I would highly recommend reading that. She also has a number of papers. So there's a paper on Kant on woman, a paper on Kant on sex. If one wants to start with something shorter than a whole book, I would highly recommend reading that. I think Pauline Kleingeld is also really excellent and very interesting to read on both sex and race in Kant.
Yeah, and if I were to compliment that, then Lucy and I stand on the shoulders of very many going before us. So you can read their writings, and then we come after them and we benefit from them and all the work they have done. And so when it comes to, let me see if I can do it for on Lucy's side of things, but certainly reading Charles Mills on Kant and racism, definitely. Help me out, Lucy.
I would say you would get very far with just reading Mills and you know, Mills. So if you, when we're to read Mills and Kleingeld on race, on Kant's racism, you'd see two sort of different sides of the view, and anybody who was interested in finding further things, that, you know, both of them have enormous numbers of references. I would start there.
Right. And if you look at me and the people whose shoulders I stand, I certainly stand very much on the shoulder of Kleingeld again. She is the one who's written on both a lot. and she was really pioneering. And also, I would probably emphasize Barbara Herman, who wrote an absolutely brilliant first piece on marriage that's been tremendously influential.
All right, and then there's if any of us get confused ever, then there are your lectures from 2017 and 2020, respectively, for Professor Warden and Professor Lucy, available on YouTube with regards to on these very topics and in a lot of detail, as I've seen them. So it was lovely having both of you and discussing Kant so comprehensively. So it was lovely having the both of you.
It was great to be part of this. Thanks very much. And I agree with you. It's great to bring these topics together, and always a pleasure to talk philosophy with Helga.
Yes, likewise. It always is a pleasure to talk with you, Lucy. And thank you for inviting me.